Welcome to We Are Libertarians, where our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking to your friends. I'm your host, Chris Spangle, and here at We Are Libertarians, we examine current events from a libertarian perspective while treating modern politics with all of the irreverence it deserves. We toss out the screaming heads and put people before political parties and give context to the news to make you think. This is a special series on We Are Libertarians called The Swamp Explained, and I am joined by Rob Quartel, a 45-year fly on the wall in Washington, D.C. Rob has worked for Republican presidential campaigns, government agencies like the EPA, and has been confirmed by the Senate to the U.S. Federal Maritime Commission. He's also been a candidate for Congress and Senate, and given his experience and iconoclastic viewpoints, Rob gives us great insight into the swamp that makes up our nation's capital. I got a Christmas card from a patron and friend of the program, J. Mark English. And in the Christmas card, he said, "I love the Swamp series. Tell Rob thank you." So I'm doing that publicly, Rob.
Oh, good.
So
Happy New Year.
People, you wouldn't expect a series about the swamp of Washington, D.C., where we try to explain it to be popular amongst libertarians, but I consistently hear that people love this show because it helps them to figure out what's going on in D.C. a lot. So it's a fun series. There's a special feed that you can get. If you go to your podcast app and search Swamp Explained, you can go back and catch up on all the past shows. And yeah. So how were your holidays, Rob? Let's start there.
Oh, well, mine were great. I left the island, took a quick trip into D.C. for to see the family. Everybody flew in, and then flew off to Dallas, where my daughter lives and works for Fossil Watch.
Oh,
and my son-in-law for Aetna. So you know, we're ensconced in the commercial swamp.
Yeah, very good. One of my most prized possessions at 15, my mom bought me a red Mustang Fossil watch, and it was
really.
I might have been like 12. Yes, I love Fossil watches, so yeah, very exciting.
I have to tell my daughter that. So yeah, be very excited.
She'll know who. Lots going on. You know, every time we get together, we get together every 2 to 4 weeks, and it just seems like we could probably do this show daily with the amount of things, you know, in the time since we've met. We've potentially started a world war. The economy may be slowing down. But you having worked for the EPA and maybe give a little bit of your history with the EPA, there was an interesting story out recently that maybe you could talk to and explain to dummies like me exactly what's going on. But Donald Trump has a habit of fighting. The thing about Donald Trump is that he's at war with his own government, and that includes scientists that in his employ. So what was the story that came out recently about Donald Trump fighting with the scientists that he employs?
Well, just I think you asked me to remind listeners a little bit of my own history with EPA. So I actually worked for it when I was a student at Rice University, probably almost 50 years ago now, when it was started under Richard Nixon. I worked as an intern during the year. And then my first real job, I drove across the country and walked into the deputy administrator's office. He happened to have been a Rice graduate, which I knew, and kind of walked out with a job where I was in charge of the water quality rules governing timber products. And as I used to joke, having grown up in Florida, I'd never really seen a tree. I'd only seen pine boards sawn from pine trees. So that was an interesting thing. And I was only there about 3, 4, 5 months and then went on to another White House agency. But, and of course, since then, it's grown. I did have an interesting run-in with Scott Pruitt, not a run-in, but lunch, sort of a meeting with him about a year ago, year and a half, right before
Is he still the
EPA? He's gone.
Okay.
He's gone. Yeah, he was the first administrator. Okay. He was the guy who wanted to get rid of it. He was the state attorney general, I think, in Kansas and a real kind of a red herring in that particular agency. But I remember sitting around a group of, I happened to be in a group primarily of mining executives and who were also engaged in international trade. That was the group I was involved with, the trade group. And as we all tell our stories, I sort of told mine that I had worked there at the beginning, and he says, "Oh, you must have started in the 80s. So, you know, and of course it was started in 19, 70-ish, 70, 71, and he knew nothing of its history. And he was subsequently pushed out. And this new administrator now who came out of, I believe he came out of the coal industry, but he's a smart DC operator. But one of the first things that he did was fire the members of the EPA's scientific advisory board. And that's, most of these agencies have science advisory boards. They're supposed to be independent and provide kind of a check the scientific rationale. You know, you want the rules to be not purely political, but it was created in 1978 by the Congress to validate the agency's scientific methods. So he had fired everybody and appointed his own scientists. And the interesting story this week is that there are four rules, major rules that they have come out with that they're about to publish. One on runoff into streams, and another on heavy metal coming out of power plants and things like that. And basically, the other day, this science board, which he had had put all his own people on it, decided that three or four of these new looser federal rules were scientifically not valid or not based on science as people customarily understand it.
And to where did he learn this information that it wasn't scientific, that he could disagree with the science board?
Oh, well, I'm sure the president hasn't figured it out yet. as on most things, I'm sure that he knows more than the scientists. Yeah. I noted that one of the other topics we may hit today is the Iraq, and he has in Iran, and he has certainly bragged that he knows more than the generals. And sometimes that might be true, that people know more politics, but I suspect they don't know more about tactics and things like that. But there, a couple of these rules are really significant. One governs mercury pollution from power plants, and then the other is what sort of chemicals can be used near waterways. And of course, the mercury issue is a really significant thing. Mercury is one of those heavy metals that when it's in pollution, whether it's water pollution or air, can work its way into the food chain. And as it's eaten in small amounts by small animals and micro animals and things like that, as they get eaten up the food chain, it gradually concentrates and it causes significant nerve damage in everything. And actually, I studied that years ago when I was at Rice. I had a grant from the National Science Foundation to put together a summer program, which employed about 10 of us. And we would go out every day with a boat that the university had given us to use for the summer, and nets, and scrape up everything we could find, and we'd take it back and analyze it. And we proved what people already knew, which is that it concentrates as it goes up the marine food chain. So I certainly have personal experience with that. So that's one. And the science board said that that and another one, which limits, which was intended to limit what sort of dredging and pesticide can take place near small streams and wetlands. The advisory board said the proposal, quote, neglects established science, unquote, that shows how contamination of all this groundwater, wetlands, and waterways can spread to drinking water. Mm. And, you know, we've had a number of major drinking water incidents in the last 10 years. And so, you know, we have drinking water is an important issue in general that people just assume everything's copacetic. But, you know, I'm sure you've read that many scientists and public health experts are very concerned about things which you would not think about. For example, if you throw your medicines, your leftover medicine down the toilet or something like that, it finds its way into the drinking water.
There's a friend of mine was just complaining about the birth control in the water and how much birth control there is actually in the water, not just from dumping the medicines, but also from urine itself.
Yeah. Well, you wouldn't know whether that's good or bad, would you? It depends on what you're trying to do.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
if you're trying to have babies, it's a bad thing. If you're not, and you just want to sow your wild oats,
yeah,
it's a good thing, I guess.
Drink out of a public stream, I guess, is the point here that we're saying.
That's right. But you'd like to know what's there.
Yeah.
And so the pesticide issue is a really, really big one. And the EPA has announced some time ago it's going to relax mileage standards on new vehicles. It wants to loosen up the runoff issue and, you know, pesticides and all that. And so it all sounds great to the uninitiated, but in fact, the way they're doing it is not based on science. So that's a problem. And it is kind of ironic that his own board has decided to go after him. And, you know, in the context of the swamp, of course, we think about a lot of the swamp is the professional civil servants. But it's also, you know, there's an old adage that when you're a political appointee and you get into an agency over a period of time, you start to self-identify with the people working for you.
Right.
And they're supposed to be objective, which by and large, you know, we've discussed they are, and they by and large try to execute the vision of an administration, no matter what their politics. But and we've also discussed the fact that this is an administration which has never to this day taken control of the government. You know, they've left probably a third of the political appointments undone. And there's, I think, this sense at the top that if they don't appoint people, they can't get anything done in the agencies. But the fact is, the agencies just run. And that's the both the good and the bad side of the swamp. You know, thank goodness the Social Security checks get out and things like that.
Right. So. I mean, there's some pros and cons to things like the swamp, which we could probably touch on. Like, if you're going to make regulations, if there have to be regulations, then don't you want them to be made out of informed data points? I mean, the problem comes in was when the data points, like, as you see in the food industry, for instance, when you weren't supposed to eat eggs, it was and you were supposed to drink lots of milk, that was the dairy industry influencing a lot of that data. But you know, in an instance like this, it's so obvious to everyone, certain things are happening environmentally. Like the ice caps really are melting, and there are serious problems in the oceans and streams with runoff from industry, from our existence. And there's a certain segment of the population, especially on the right, and probably many of our listeners, who kind of grab facts out of the air, it seems, and Donald Trump is just the king of this. Like I call him the talk radio president because he's like every talk radio caller I ever had when I was at WXNT, and he just sort of grabs facts out of the air based on what he sees on television or may hear on a podcast or may read or hear in conversation from his buddies, and that is he just goes with his gut as opposed to decision making like you might find from a science board like this, where they're trying to be thorough, they're trying to be. So sometimes I think anti-institutionalists, I might call them, make these knee-jerk reactionary decisions, and it undercuts a professional, you know, institution that is trying to make regulations based in science and fact. I mean, maybe I'm committing heresy here by saying that, but I think if we're going to make regulations and Congress has mandated certain things, like I'd rather scientists make it than Donald Trump.
Well, yes. And of course, this is some of this is on the part of the regulatory, the administration is purely punishment. One of these sounds like it came right out of Ken Cuccinelli, who was the attorney general in Virginia and now is and Ken is a very he's a very conservative guy. I agree with some things, mostly disagree with a lot of it, his tactics. But he got into a kind of a pissing contest with some of the scientists up at Virginia Tech some number of years ago about he didn't like the results of some of their studies and demanded access to the raw data, and they wouldn't, and the emails from the researchers and all those things, and they rightly said it's none of your business. But so one of these other decisions here is that the administration's been trying to push is to exclude from any scientific studies that are used for decision making those studies where researchers withhold their raw data. And, you know, that's just not, as the board said, consistent with the scientific method. So, you know, these are the kinds of things where they're kind of political assertions being made on the part of the administration, and the scientists are pushing back saying, sorry, that's not science. And that's not the scientific method, and so on and so forth. So, anyway, it's very interesting. It's somewhat amusing. It's disturbing in its own way, because, you know, we know that many environmental laws go too far and some don't go far enough. And you would hope that there would be somebody objective in the process at the administration side to kind of balance that. But they undercut themselves.
Well, it seems like, just like I didn't know Scott Pruitt, I can't keep all these people straight. It's a continuous revolving door, and what you've seen in the Trump administration is a shrinking of the competent people. And I mean, at this point, why would you want to go work for Donald Trump in any capacity? Because you're either going to end up in jail or you're going to get fired, and your reputation will be ruined. Like, it doesn't seem to. I honestly don't know. I think the greatest counter argument to his argument against his reelection is, how does he staff a second administration? Because it's always difficult for presidents in their second term to staff, and it's going to be profoundly more difficult for Donald Trump, because, like you said, he hasn't filled a third of the government.
Well, and then the position he fills that are really the high level ones, he's very erratic about how he treats the people in it. You know, most people would just as soon not have a public dressing down on everyone makes mistakes, even at very high levels. But you would hope that your boss would be willing to sit down with you privately rather than make it a matter of public. I just think about Jeff Sessions when he was Attorney General, how often the Trump just went after him, excoriating him in public. It's shameful. But you're right. I do remember, though, at the beginning of the administration, someone saying to me, who would work for this guy? You know, he's such a sexist jackass and everything else. That was their characterization. And my response was, anybody who is a patriot, if the president of the United States calls you and asks, you have to give it consideration, you know. And most people who are like that, who you want in the government, think enough about themselves to believe that they have something to offer, and that, you know, they like an opportunity to be able to persuade the president or other people to change their mind or to move them or something like that. But I think he's run out of a lot of the credibility around that. An awful lot of people have seen a lot of their friends burned on both sides. So yeah, I do think it will be harder to staff a second one. But you know, Chris, the Democrats are doing everything they can to reelect him.
It seems so, yes.
I mean, this whole impeachment thing, it's almost irrelevant as to whether it's an impeachable offense or what. I think the act of doing it, and doing it in such a highly political way, has simply pushed people back into their corners. So you've got the people who voted for Hillary or against Trump pushed to one side, and the people who voted for Trump or against Hillary pushed in the other. And you know, everybody's waving their hands and saying that 51% is for impeachment and conviction now, I think, depending on one poll or the other. But that won't change the election results. That just pushes people into their corners. So
yeah,
it's too bad. And of course, now we have the whole issue of the gamesmanship with Nancy Pelosi and McConnell and that's all pretty interesting to watch too. And you know, I think the Post this morning, some columnist somewhere said there were four potential outcomes, ranging from Pelosi not sending the impeachment over at all. And as your listeners know, impeachment is really indictment, not really removal. Right. And so not sending it along until such time as she thought she could inflict maximum political damage, which might be in the fall, or alternatively, hoping that he doesn't get reelected and then tee it up back in, you know, in the end of the year and then do something there, to sending it over and McConnell ignoring it, or sending it over and McConnell, or McConnell simply ignoring her altogether and either running the trial without it, or doing a mock trial, just like the mock impeachment. So there are all sorts of iterations of this. And if it weren't so momentous in terms of the politics of this country, it would be amusing, but it's, they are treating it like a game.
So Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who basically controls a lot of the Senate at this point, said that he wasn't going to treat it fairly. It wasn't a serious impeachment. And so Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, said she didn't directly say, unless she's made statements after the initial one that I'm going off of, basically, if you read between the lines, it seemed like she wasn't going to send the articles of impeachment to the House until there was a fair hearing of the articles of impeachment in the Senate. And I think conservatives kind of took that and ran with it a little bit. And one columnist, I think, in the Washington Post wrote that it wasn't an official impeachment until the Senate received the articles of impeachment. And the hilarious thing about this impeachment is having the ability to go back to Clinton's impeachment and watch the very same people say the opposite things, like Lindsey Graham.
Oh, yeah.
Or in the case of Chuck Schumer saying, you know, the Senate is supposed to be an impartial jury. And then you go back to the Clinton impeachment. Well, you know, the Senate isn't actually a jury. You know, you have the exact, it's literally just cross the other side of the street and pick up the other guy's signs. And that, I think, is why most Americans aren't taking any of this seriously, is because they don't seem to be taking it seriously. You're in a rush 1 minute and then you're holding it the next.
Well, it's interesting. And again, it's sort of amusing to watch, both sides play this game. So the Democrats are outraged, just outraged that McConnell says we'll treat it politically, and that he says he's not unbiased, and most of the Republicans are not unbiased. But I wonder if anyone believes that any of the Democrats are unbiased and their minds have not already been made up, nor could they possibly have doubted whether the congressman running the impeachment whether their minds were made up or not. So I think everybody's minds have been made up from the beginning on where they want to land.
Right.
So it's kind of ridiculous. The other thing I do find somewhat amusing too is, regardless of where you stand on it, the Democrats, to watch them on the tube, are saying, well, this is different than the Clinton impeachment. In this one, the president has committed a crime, although notably they did not impeach him for a crime. Whereas Clinton was just about sex.
Right.
And if you recall, Clinton was about lying to, yes, it was about sex, but he lied. He was the chief political officer and chief legal officer of the United States, lying to a prosecutor. So that, to me, irrespective of the topic, makes it worse and more impeachable, probably. And he certainly was impeached. The other aspect of that is that had thought about it at the time. Here, I was a business guy, and I certainly would have gone to jail for lying to a prosecutor.
Yeah.
But I would have gone to jail and lost my entire assets and my company and everything else if I had had sex with an intern working for me.
Mm.
That is a really good example of this whole thing is kind of it's not exactly double. It is double standards of the Washington environment. But it's also, it just underscores how much of this is theater.
Well, I think theater is a great way to put it. I think in both of these cases, you have the scientific board saying, we need to follow the scientific method. It's like, well, yeah, but if the conclusion supported different, like, as I do, that a board of any kind will choose to emphasize the best case for their argument. Donald Trump is in his long and weird counter argument letter to Nancy Pelosi, was presenting his best evidence, the best truth that made him look good. So are the Democrats. And I think that's why it's confusing for people, because you hear like Donald Trump say they're out to get me. The deep state is out to get me. And then you see the McCabes of the world and Bruce Orr and Page and Strzok, and you go, oh, there's some validity to that argument. But then you hear the Democrats' argument of this guy's, you know, withholding congressionally delegated funds, and he shouldn't be doing that either. And so people just kind of throw up their hands and go, all right, everybody sounds right, and I don't know who I agree with, so I'm just going to go with my gut. And
or with my tribe.
Exactly.
As the case may be. But, you know, again, there's some illustrations here of the swamp and the professional civil service and everything else. So I think it's pretty widely accepted that the Russians intervened in the last election using social media and memes and all of these things, which falsehoods, which get people all ramped up and excited about one thing or another. And they're still doing it. And we have a number of different parties doing it. And I suspect the Iranians are going to be doing something along that line pretty soon, because they have a pretty good cyber capability. And so you have the president basically ignoring all that and fingering the Ukrainians, kind of a mythology here. But irrespective of all the hand-waving and everything else, the Congress appropriated money to the states to actually beef up their cyber operations. So from the level of the election integrity, I think we thankfully have people working on that, notwithstanding all of the hand waving, both on the physical security of the machines and the data and on alternative methodology. So a lot of states have moved from purely electronic to both printing a record as well as doing the electronic so you can count it, but so you can also validate it with a paper record. What they can't do at the state level anything about is moving large masses of people by virtue of fake information and, insinuations and innuendo and all the rest of this. And it's complexified today by the ability to make false videos. So now you can actually make videos of candidates saying something they absolutely did not say.
Deep fakes.
By being able to manipulate the pixels in the lips. That's a lot more dangerous. And some of the major social media players have attempted to do some things around that, trying to figure out what's false and what's not. And of course, that creates its own argument. Do we want Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg et al. Censoring or deciding what is real and what's not real? So, we have some issues there too. So, and that's much more dangerous, frankly, from the standpoint that, that's pure propaganda.
Absolutely.
And people can't distinguish what's propaganda and what's not. I think I read the other day that something like 65% of what you see on the internet is fake. And I would believe that.
I think that is that sort of goes to the libertarian argument, not to offend our friend Henry Olson, or Tyler Cowen, but should the stakes be this high? The way to undercut a lot of these threats are to take more power away from the presidency, return to Congress or states or localities. I don't personally believe that there's any way that we can centralize the government more and have it function. It's already not functioning, and the way forward is localism. There's never really an argument. The bigger question is, should there be so much at stake? Should there be so much at stake of the presidency and who he appoints to boards and who gets elected? Because it seems to me that because everything is, there's just so much information out there that people kind of give up on focusing on down ballot races. And so they just focus on the president. I can tell you from our numbers, this will be my fourth political cycle with We Are Libertarians, fourth presidential cycle. the response after an election or during an election year. I've spent 2 years working on getting We Are Libertarians, getting the formula right, getting the team right, getting the shows that I want on the network right, getting the look right. I'm working on new graphics. Like, because the presidential year brings so many new people to it. Yeah. So many people pay so much more attention. And they shouldn't. They should pay attention all the time or to local races but the stakes are just so high at the top level now. I think that's the thing that really bugs me.
Well, that's an interesting question though. The stakes are high, but where do the stakes matter? So on the day-to-day stuff of people's lives, generally, they have not, you know, there is a distinction between what the feds, the federal government, and the state government and the local governments can do, the impact they have. Although, you know, today, the federal government can make massive changes that have real impact. I was thinking in December, I was trying to pay my real estate property taxes before the end of the year. And I'm thinking, well, does it make a difference or not? and then, of course, it actually doesn't make a difference. I live in a high real estate property state now and have valuable property and I exceed my limit. And same thing on a variety of deductions, all of which were changed by the Congress under Trump, which is ironic given that he's a real estate guy, but you know, you were talking about, we were talking a minute ago about information and fake information and how people get it and the stakes. You know, I think I may have talked about this book before. I finished the book by a woman, Jill Lepore, who's an historian in Harvard. So you may assume she's on a left of center, which she is. She wrote a book called These Truths, which is a one volume history of the United States and a very, very good writer. And you know, she makes some errors in the book. One of my friends pointed out she had said there were jet planes. She had a paragraph in there about jet planes attacking the beaches at Normandy, and there were no jets at that point. And she's since changed it. And another one about Roe v. Wade that she named as one of the parties to it an individual, the prosecutor, who was really not the person. It was really the county by the same name, and then stuff like that. But she sort of starts it out on this thesis of many people came here. Most people came here originally to seek freedom for religion or economics or whatever. But parallel to that, from the very first day, there were people who were brought without freedom. You know, they were slaves in the Spanish colonies and Virginia and everything else. And part of the book is sort of how these two tracks parallel through American history and the conflict with that. But one of the things she really does well is talk about the changes in media and information in modern times. And one of the things she points out is how each of these waves of technology has had a big impact on the political equation, starting with newspapers, literally in the 1820s, and the first most paper organs before that were political organs. So you know you have somebody for the Whigs and somebody for the other guys, and back and forth.
Here in Indiana,
you had the first independent newspaper that took the position that it was going to report the news as news, and then and opinion would be separate, and then. And then, of course, you had the telegraph, which was supposed to unite the country, and because everybody would be receiving information of the same kind all at the same time, which was somewhat true, and that changed the nature of elections in its own way. And then from there to radio and similar impact, Roosevelt's ability to use it, and then to TV, and I think Eisenhower was probably the first guy to use it, and then Kennedy really won an election on it, and now we have social media and all of these things. But one of the things she talked about is how there was a time in TV when we all pretty much got the same message, and that was when we had three networks, And they, under the then FCC rules, they were required to present both sides, not take, you know, a position advocating for a particular position. And those rules were changed under Reagan. So they do not have to have balanced coverage anymore. And now, of course, we have cable and I turn on my TV and I have 1,000 channels. You know, down here, as I've said before, we don't get newspapers, not on a daily basis. I can get the Wall Street Journal at the post office. It comes in the mail every day, day of, at noon. But everything else is online. So I started watching television, which I had not done very much for years and years. And all that's on is the three impeachment channels and then Fox and then BBC, which is boring most of the time, and European focused, and then the headline news, and then you know, I rediscovered the ABC, CBS, NBC, and I'm always struck by the fact that, well, they still kind of report the news in a kind of unbiased sort of way. I mean, I'm sure they have biases, but it feels more like news in the old way we used to think of news. But her main point was that when there were just the three channels and the regulation requiring balance, that in fact everybody was essentially getting the same set of news and the same set of facts, and there was a consensus around what the facts were. And that you do not have that now.
No, there's no consensus, and consensus is a losing proposition. And, yeah. and media,
and it's ironic that you can't get consensus around facts.
Just a chain of events. Like you can literally read Peter Baker and Maggie Haberman in the New York Times. And I actually just did an interview with Tom LoBianco right before this that'll come out the same week, probably the same day maybe as this. And we talk about Mike Pence. And in that interview, I talked to him because he's an investigative journalist who's worked for the AP. And I posed questions on how do you know what's the truth? What's your process? How do you do interviews? How do you know that Karen Pence was mad at Mike Pence for winning vice presidency on election night? Like, how do you know? How do you find that stuff out? And he kind of walks through the process. And I typically, when I read something in the New York Times, go, I'm sure that the difference between the New York Times and We Are Libertarians is that while I work very hard to make sure that I say things that are true, there isn't a second or third layer fact-checking me. It is me giving my opinion into a microphone, and with the AP and other news outlets, yes, there is bias because there's bias in story selection, but there's layers of fact-checkers that typically will look through these things. And what you found in the Trump administration is that a lot of the stuff that was reported at the time by the New York Times early on has borne out to be true, has been admitted by Trump himself that a lot of that was true, that the Mueller investigation validated a lot of what the Times, for instance, reported. But it is personally advantageous to either political side, but specifically a person where truth usually isn't in the equation with Donald Trump, it's easier for him. I heard something about I forget what the historical analogy was, where the person was basically, I think it might have been Nixon, and Woodward basically said, well, he's going to have to just blame, he's just going to have to come after us because he has no defense. And that's kind of become, that's how you know somebody's just kind of been caught, is when they just start attacking the messenger as opposed to what's being said in the message. And that's sort of been the bad part, the anti-intellectual part of the Trump era, is that we're not now even agreeing on basic facts anymore.
Well, and actually you could call it the conspiracy presidency. Everything's a conspiracy against him, and or explanation for actions he took or everything else. I was just thinking to myself, maybe you and I should start a non-fact-based rumor. So I'm actually sort of convinced. We were talking earlier before the show about how it's interesting that no one has talked about who would become president if Trump were in fact convicted, and that would be one Vice President Mike Pence. And Pence, of course, is people think of him as sort of low key and religious and all that, but he's actually aggressively self-promoting in his own way, and he really wants to be president. Now, if I were Trump, I think I would consider getting rid of Pence for somebody like Nikki Haley. So maybe you and I should promote a new conspiracy theory today that Trump's going to dump Pence and name Haley as his vice presidential candidate.
I don't know why you think it's a conspiracy. I heard that. Yeah, it's the truth.
I heard it somewhere.
Spread the rumor. Lo Bianco did say that he thought that Pence would be on the ticket, that legally they're kind of starting to be tied together. But yeah, that is interesting that nobody's there. I just think like the impeachment stuff seems like such a foregone conclusion. And you don't know, like, what I think listeners need to keep in mind is that when you're in the heat of it, this is one of the benefits of studying history. Going back and reading like Robert Caro's book on LBJ, or, you know, reading about Watergate, when you're in the heat of it and you're reading the newspaper, that seems really big. But then when you have some hindsight to it, it wasn't as big, or maybe some of the facts weren't as solid. You know, there can be falsehoods there, and that's why Trump's conspiracy mongering works, is because there is a somewhat legitimate argument that there are people within his government working against him, as evidenced by the new book called A Warning by an anonymous person working for him. You know, there are people in the deep state, in the swamp, who are aggressively working after him. And I think it's part of what we do here is try to determine, like, all right, what is a deep state conspiracy and what is just a person that is concerned for the Republic trying to save it from someone who so clearly has many, many issues and, you know, unilaterally kills the second in command in Iran, for instance.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Well, that
without
absolutely.
Congressional approval.
Of course, again, the other thing I was thinking about on that today, and I'm sure your listeners know that we did a drone assassination of Soleimani, who was the head of the Qud, the Iranian alternate army. So they have their own national army, and then the Qud is really the special guard. And
they're the ones who really, the Pentagon says that he's responsible for 17% of the deaths of Americans in Iraq. Now, after the Afghan papers, why would we believe anything the Pentagon says? But yeah, I mean, this is not a person that I'm mourning the loss of.
Yeah,
but it's strategically.
But I do
important.
Think I was flipping through channels this morning and watching the various analysts. You know, there are days when I can't. Most of the time, I can't stand Morning Joe. But every so often, he'll have when he's not talking about impeachment, he actually has a group of very interesting foreign policy guys who will show up, and they did today. And then I flipped over to some other one, and I was really struck by the assertions of so many analysts that there was no strategy there. You know, I do think Trump is not strategic. He's tactical, but people in the Pentagon game these things out before they present the alternative. And you and I both know that they will have done that. They are not about to recommend to the president an alternate course of action unless they actually have gamed it out. And the secretary, Esper, Mark Esper, is a very intelligent guy by all accounts, and he's not a crazy. I think people don't know what the consequences will be, but I am pretty certain that at least the defense establishment has spent a lot of time thinking about what they might be, whether they're likely to be strikes on civilians or cyber strikes or whatever. And of course, I think everyone is pretty aware that the Iranians, when they may not be aware, actually the Iranians have a tremendous cyber capability. And so it's going to be, I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I you know, that's just kind of this attitudinal thing. There is a set of people who, no matter what the administration does, are going to be against it. And
hi.
Very well. Yeah, but there are things that they do that you probably think you and I can disagree with the method.
Right.
It was about time to punch the Chinese in the nose. But personally, I would rather see our allies with them. And you have to remember that the Obama administration was the one that let the Chinese form their development bank because we weren't aggressive enough on our side. And so, you know, the Chinese thing's been a long march through a lot of administrations. But
well, I think Trump hurts himself because he is so knee-jerk that when he does take action, yeah, like the killing of this Iranian general, people think, oh, well, this is probably just him, you know, like him, like he has an Atari controller in his office and he's like, I see that general in Baghdad, I'm going to kill him. You know, and that's just not how the system works.
You're starting to sound like Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I think if people understood the process better, they'd go, no, this was a systematic, like, they got intelligence. He probably was asked, do you want to take this action? And it was decided fairly quickly because he was on the ground moving in Baghdad.
Yeah.
But it was not necessarily him just knee-jerk reacting. Like, nobody thinks that he thinks through a lot of consequences, but I'm sure a lot of other people did think through the consequences before they brought that information to him.
I'm sure that's true. I will say, though, that what has historically prevented the United States and American presidents from engaging in an assassination has been that we don't want to open the floodgates for others to do the same to us.
Yeah.
So it's you know, this kind of thing does open the gates to a quid pro quo. I hate to use that term, but it does, you know.
So is that a bad thing, though? And I know that
If we're going to go around assassinating other people, then we shouldn't be invulnerable to the same thing.
And I feel the same about information warfare. Like, you know, I don't have a lot of sympathy for the Democrats crying, well, Russia interfered in our elections, when, like, hello. I mean, nobody interferes in more elections than we do and have for the last 100 years. So
yeah,
I feel like a little taste of our own medicine will make people wake up and go, oh, holy crap.
But I assume you're not taking the Trump position, which is that we're the bad guys too.
No, I think that we it comes down to force. Like, is this person somebody that I want to stay alive? No, but it is. I tried to think about in the other guy's shoes. If I'm Soleimani, I don't like it. Let's take Osama bin Laden, for instance. Okay, let's go gold, platinum standard enemy of the United States here. If you read what Osama bin Laden said and why he believed the things that he believed, and he wasn't an irrational person. And I think as Americans, especially somebody who was 18 at the time, you go, this guy's just a monster. How could this person do this? And then when you get older and a little more sophisticated and understand more about the world, you go, okay, that's why this guy made these choices. He's profoundly evil and he's wrong. And he decided to take his anger out in a completely counterproductive manner, but he's not an irrational, crazy person. And I think that's where Americans, there are people who bristled at me saying that Osama bin Laden was a rational person. We want to just demonize that other person, and that's not how it works all the time. So,
well, yeah, I think this is where we're in this period of history where not every actor is thinking through, are there other means for me to accomplish what I'd like to accomplish? Partly this is the disintegration of all of these institutions that were built up after World War II by the swamp to prevent war. So, and they have. NATO was intentionally set up to, at the one side, it was for mutual defense, but it was also to rope into the equation the actors who had started the previous wars. And so a different kind of alliance, and that really lasted for 50, 60 years. And people can't today really don't have any, I think, no sense. They have no sense of how fearful people were after World War II, which followed World War I by not even really 20 years, 20, maybe 20 years, from one massive war to the next, and the same actors involved in it, you know, the Germans primarily, but, and so people really wanted to stop it. We built institutions. We built the bank, the World Bank. We built, supportive institutions, OPEC and all of these various interlocking financial institutions to help countries develop. And we created foreign aid in order to try to encourage economic growth and stability. You know, the whole theory was that if people could express themselves through a government and believe that they could express themselves, that they were listened to, that if they had economic growth and they knew one day they'd be better off than when they started, the world would be more stable. And there's a lot of proof of that. But today we're also, as these institutions disintegrate, it's because I'm not sure they are as responsive to the new economic order, where the rich are getting richer at a rate much faster than everybody else is progressing. So,
which gives our some credence to the, let's say, the more Alex Jonesy crowd, that these institutions are a way to redistribute wealth to the most powerful and to continue to enslave third world countries. And so when you say, you know, these institutions, well, yes, it brought about stability, it brought about prosperity. It's not fair to say that we were war free, but I think people don't have a concept in my generation, in the millennial generation, of how all encompassing World War I and World War II were, especially World War II.
Yeah.
And even to Vietnam, because I lived through Iraq and Afghanistan, which 5% of the population fought, if that, you know, which is barely
not that.
It's
probably
not
five,
that.
One half of 1%.
And so that's the tension when you're promised by the UN that we're going to give the world peace, and then it doesn't happen. You go, well, this institution's flawed and doesn't work. Why are you taking my money?
But, you know, to that, the point of the number you just threw out, very few people actually fight the wars in which we're engaged. So I suspect the percentage of Americans who actually were engaged in Afghanistan and Iran, Iraq, and all those Middle Eastern wars to date, if it's a 0.5% of the population, eligible population, I would be surprised. Mm-hmm. Vietnam, which felt all-encompassing to this society, was no more than about 3%. Of all of the eligible Americans, people who are eligible to go to war and fight for the country or fight against Vietnam or whatever, went into the war. That's because half of the population right away could not. That was women, young women. And then a number of people got college deferments, myself included. The war ended before I was out, you know, and all that. And Trump, for bone spurs, as we know.
Several times.
Actually, you know, we had this big period in the Congress where I think there was one veteran left in the entire Congress. Now, all of a sudden, we had this big influx of both female and male combat veterans, which I think is a great thing. They tend to be less inclined to war. The last president who was really a veteran and saw combat was George H.W. Bush. And who knows, we'll probably have another who has eventually. But the number of people actually end up fighting in the war zone is very small. But, of course, the impact's huge. And the cost is huge. You know, we fortunately have so many more people who were injured in these wars surviving, but their injuries are frequently horrific. And that's very costly, both to the individual and to society as a whole. Wars are bad.
I agree. Well, we're almost... go ahead.
No, that's right. And who knows what we're on the brink of. So it's going to be a different kind of war.
You know, I know people roll their eyes when I say Glenn Beck, but, you know, he has long said the Tunisian fruit vendor that lit himself on fire that began the Arab Spring was the Franz Ferdinand moment. And I've never forgotten him saying that, because there is maybe 100 years from now, when people look back with hindsight, they'll go, the Arab Spring was the beginning, because that unrest went from the Middle East all the way to Brexit, to Trump, to China, to Russia. I mean, that unrest, yeah. and France is still has the yellow vests fighting. You have South American countries erupting, Hong Kong. I mean, it is a global movement by the middle and lower classes against the upper classes and institutions. And it really did begin with that Tunisian fruit vendor. And so who knows where does that end up?
And what it's all about. Yeah. Well, and what it's all about, Chris, is the ability or the belief that what you as an individual say or believe matters to someone in a leadership position.
Yeah.
Your voice is heard, whether or not they agree or whether it becomes the end position. And that can be well-off middle-class people like the Hong Kong students, or it can be this vendor who was disrespected by the police and made a very powerful protest and on. It's quite the range of politics here is all over the place, but I think the cause is still the same. So,
well, we are almost out of time, so that means we end the program with your recommendations for food or drink or attractions if people visit the nation's capital, which they should.
Yeah.
Washington, D.C. is a very fun town, a very interesting town. And while you're there, what should people do?
Well, I'll tell you, there are so many new restaurants in Washington. I have a list of about 25 that I need to get myself to. There's a restaurant, some I have not been to yet, Seven Reasons on 14th Street, my old stomping ground, Latin American. I want to get to Modena, which is Italian in downtown, and by another one of the great Italian chefs. There's Wolfgang Puck, who came from California to create a terrific restaurant at the now defunct museum, has a new one out called Cut. Tommy, T-H-A-M-E-E on H Street is near a really cool area, Union Market, which has some interesting sort of Burmese. There are some new pizza joints, Stellina. There's a restaurant at the top of the new Hilton, the Conrad, which is especially Hilton, smack dab downtown, a really high end, has a restaurant at the top called Estuary, which is by two chefs, Brian and Michael Voltaggio. They had a great restaurant out in Frederick, Maryland, called Volt. Another one called Call Your Mother. I love the names. One that I have tried that's on the list is called Rooster and Owl, 14th Street. It's the name for the chef, the nickname for the chef who's Owl and the daytime chef who's Rooster. But it's Asian and it's not Asian, but it's a mixed variety of things that include some Asian. Anju is another one. It's a whole raft. Another one that's currently recommended is St. Anselm, which is known for its meats. That's up in the Union Market area. But my goal is to get through a bunch of these and have some new ones to report on.
All right.
Next time we're around.
Well, we look forward to it, and we'll talk to you here.
And I'll be fatter because of it.
Good. Good. Sounds delicious. Isn't an estuary, is that a bird sanctuary? What is estuary?
Estuary is where it's like a marsh.
It's
the part of the estuary, of the marsh area where all these baby species grow and are nurtured. It's like a nursery.
Sounds swampy.
It is.
Very
Maybe
good.
That's why we like it.
Well, thanks for joining us here on this episode of The Swamp Explained. And Rob, any final thoughts for our listeners?
I'll tell you one final thought to think about as you watch the primaries. We're not even a month away from the first of the caucuses, is how Lily White, the Democratic primary process has become. I think the very last of the non-white candidates dropped out yesterday, and some who were there may be one left. I guess from New Jersey,
Cory Booker.
Cory Booker is the last one in, but I don't believe he's qualified for the debate. So when you see the debate, it's down to the all-white cast, and there may be, I think, Amy Klobuchar has qualified.
It's interesting to me that, you know, on that note, it's the most diverse field. It's the most diverse field, and Democrats, the very people who are kind of choosing the next crop of candidates. It's like Democrats. Here's my point. Democrats lecture everyone else, including Republicans, about diversity, but they're the ones who chose this field with their donations, with their results, you know, and so.
Right.
It sort of betrays their own values.
And then there's Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah, Michael Bloomberg.
I think Michael Bloomberg has had the best line in the entire campaign so far when someone asked him what he thought about all the billionaires in the race, and he said, who's the other one?
Right, yeah, between him and Trump.
So it's great. Happy New Year to you and the listeners. And my resolution is that we do this more frequently.
Excellent. Sounds good. I appreciate your time, and we'll talk to you, audience, at a later date. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, bye-bye.